You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people. Produced at 3CR Community Radio in Naarm, Melbourne, and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. My name is Phuong Tran. Women on the Line acknowledges that this program is produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and that their sovereignty was never ceded. We acknowledge their elders past and present, as well as the traditional owners of the land on which you're hearing us from. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. On this week's episode, we look into big tech companies, their complicity in war, their pervasive use of surveillance and data, and the impacts this is having on us as individuals, as artists, and as communities. Our first conversation is with Cher Tan, an essayist and critic whose written work has been published widely. Cher delves into the dark side of Spotify, its ties to the military-industrial complex, its role in stripping artists of their rights and dignity, as well as the way it has homogenized art and culture. Later in the program, we'll hear an interview with Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, which aired on 3CR's Tuesday Breakfast on 12th of August 2025. In this interview, Lucinda outlines the latest Productivity Commission report, which calls for a pause on AI regulation, how this benefits big tech companies, and the negative impacts this will have on our privacy. Cher Tan is an essayist and critic whose written work has been published widely. Her critically acclaimed debut book, Peripathetic, Notes on Unbelonging, is out with New South Publishing. She plays music in her spare time and lives and works on unceded Wurundjeri country. I reached out to Cher after reading her essay, Spotify is Worse Than You Think, published in Kill Your Darlings.
My name is Cher Tan. I'm an essayist and critic, and I mostly write on arts and culture, but through an anti-capitalistic lens. I have written essays, you know, questioning the role of the influencer. I've written about essays thinking about, you know, thinking through the psychological war that we're going through. And yeah, I've written a lot about the sociology of the internet over the years. And it's something that I find very intertwined with the way we live now, especially as big tech encroaches on our day-to-day lives.
So I wanted to speak to you about the essay that you wrote called Spotify is Worse Than You Think. And just to start, you reference Liz Pelly's book, Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist throughout your article. So for listeners who have never heard of this book before, how would you summarize it? And why should people read it?
Yeah, so this book has been a long time in the making. Liz Pelly has been reporting on Spotify specifically as a music journalist since, I think, the early 2010s. And this book's a debut book, and I wrote that essay sort of as a review of the book as well, while inserting my own opinions about Spotify, as well as what I learned from the book itself, which is actually a really a damning investigation and expose into Spotify since the company started in 2006, and you know how it's evolved over the years. And in the book, which, you know, it's so rich in information about what's going on in the background, and she writes about how the platform is basically a continuation of, you know, one of Thomas Edison's subsidiaries, you know, that famous inventor, Mood Music, and how data was gathered from, you know, particular implementations to sell their products back to the consumers, because I think at the time Edison Inc. had this signature vinyl record type thing called the Diamond Disc. And then from there, Pelly also writes about, you know, how Spotify is an adaptation of Muzak, which, you know, sort of started out as a subscription service and was further developed and outsourced to create like so-called the music that we know as Muzak today, right? Like we know Muzak, it's like this kind of nothing music you hear in hotel toilets, right, or something. And the book has so many interviews. There's like more than 100 interviews, and it digs really deep. It interviews, indie label managers, like musicians themselves, ex-Spotify staff who are obviously de-identified, union reps, and they all talk about how Spotify is seriously changing the landscape for musicians while also, giving the false promise that the app itself is, meritocratic, which Daniel Ek, the CEO, is constantly going on about in his PR spiels, like simply the will of the people, when certain music becomes popular. But Liz Paley also writes, there are many hidden algorithms and what are called dark patterns that are baked into user experience of the app, and like much of social media basically. And then it forces independent musicians to think like, pop stars basically, where you have to have lots of streams in order to make any kind of money at all. But obviously it's a losing game because we're talking peanuts. Like Spotify is one of the, everyone knows this. I think it's something that is shared online a lot where they say, musicians get paid one of the lowest per stream. And it's something like, $100 or 30,000 streams. So, you're kind of swimming against the tide, if you decide to participate. And then, of course, we now know that Daniel Ek is very closely associated with this German weapons tech company called Helsing. And in recent times, he's become the chairman of the company as well. And they're looking to expand further into war zones. And, he's mentioned in interviews before. What do you say? He said AI, mass, and autonomy are driving the new battlefield. Which, if you want me to pass that, is basically saying he's going all in, he's going to capitalize on war, especially in a time when death is the most profitable business in existence. And while Moon Machine doesn't really go into that too deeply, it talks about all the ways that it actually changes culture and harvests data in a way that contributes to, I guess, what I call the gentrification of the mind, because you are encouraging a certain kind of homogeneity due to seeing, viral or algorithmically friendly creations, right? Like you want people to hear you or see you. So you see someone becoming viral and you're like, oh, okay, this is maybe how I should do it in order to become an artist or a musician. And that is quite dangerous for arts and culture in general, I think.
There's so much that you've said just now about not just the book, but the way in which Spotify and other big tech companies, but for the purpose of this discussion, Spotify has infiltrated our lives through art, culture, the livelihood of artists, but also, like you said, its involvement or its full participation in the military industrial complex. I was wondering if we could start there. You mentioned this quote that's also in your piece, Gore Capitalism. I think it's by scholar Saya Valencia, in which death has become the most profitable business in existence. And you also talk about this current time that we're living in with the genocide being perpetrated by Israel in Palestine. We're seeing what's happening in Ukraine as well, and a movement which is not new at all, but there seems to be an escalation and a real focus now on boycotting and divestment and sanctioning, and people are becoming more and more aware of how they are complicit through their use of certain platforms or through their
Through purchasing whatever items that are associated with this kind of death and destruction. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could reflect on that through your research, through your writing of technology and the internet, how those things have become so inextricably linked with the military industrial complex, and how we as consumers and people who use these platforms are affected as well.
Yeah. So I guess these platforms and the internet has always been some kind of double-edged sword in that it was never from the get-go created to be totally democratic. It's just that humans ourselves, we have used it in such a way that has encouraged collectivization and, we share information with one another. These are the ways we have managed to circumvent the original intentions of big tech platforms. And, it went from 1.0 and now we're at 2.0, which means it's less of the more innocent internet that people tend to wax lyrical about. It's a particular technocracy, you can say, because all these companies are now blatantly, they have been in the background over time and they've always been capitalistic. I mean, let's not delude ourselves about that, but like now they're blatantly talking about working closely with governments and neoliberal institutions to change the way art and culture looks and is received. It's a kind of art washing while supporting the military industrial complex basically. And they're sort of creating this uncritical dependency, right, where people's natural curiosities are getting chipped away because as I was saying, the dark patterns that we have seen that is baked into Spotify, they're also baked into other platforms such as the meta ones like Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do even a little bit of research online, you can see that there are all these different ways that these platforms are working to introduce more functionalities that then continues to harvest data, redirect moods, cause outrage in a way that is not productive to basically the survival of humanity. And yes, to sort of encourage a kind of new normal, which is, I think, in this particular time, which we are living wartime, because even though, right, say in so-called Australia, it doesn't look like physical war is here, as opposed to say in Palestine or Ukraine, but what we're seeing is a psychological war, an information war, if you will, where there's this constant butting up against of what's truth and what's not. And AI is a huge part of it, and it's basically the weaponization of these platforms, because it's not that these platforms in themselves are bad, because they can be useful, as we've seen, how in this current time of mainstream media's failings, we can share information and news very quickly in order to create a record and boost, say, mutual aid initiatives and things like that. So they have been weaponized to serve by these actors, basically, Zuckerberg and Meta, Musk and X, Eck and Spotify, et cetera. And it's been weaponized to serve anti-human pro-capital interests, so they can consolidate their power in the artistic cultural sphere that then, as I was saying, encourage a kind of new normal, which is, I think, a kind of revisionism, because it then leverages on, amnesia and speed to sort of rewrite history. And that's why you see so much decontextualization as well, which I think speaks back again to what I was saying about gentrification of the mind, because you kind of forget that there are predecessors and you're like, oh, this is new, this new thing, when actually it may not be.
Yeah, and that decontextualization, that purposeful erasure of history and the lack of acknowledgement of predecessors. I mean, it's not like art and culture is created in a vacuum out of thin air.
Yeah.
It's a response to something, a constant like dialogue with whatever is around you. I know that that comes up a lot in your essay, and it goes back to, that term that you mentioned before, muzak, which is, like you say in your article, music designed for anywhere and anyone, but for nowhere and no one. And I guess that can be then further applied to other artistic forms and other examples of culture that we see where it's sort of nothing,
Exactly, like defect.
My final question for you today goes back to what you were saying earlier, and this is another message that runs through your piece, which is, the role of art and culture for people in big tech and for people like Ek. Like, it's very much a way of accumulating wealth and capital, and also using it for surveillance and sort of like insidious means. At a time when we are living through war times, where the control and the influence of big tech companies can sometimes feel overwhelming, how do you see the role of art and culture, at a time like this?
I think the role art and culture is so much more crucial than ever. Like, it's about really engaging with the politics of the now and producing meaningful work that, isn't like the muzak that we talk about for anything, everyone, nowhere, no one. It's to really accelerate as they escalate. I feel that we should escalate too as artists and, consumers of art, etc. There needs to be, more of a groundswell of resistance, basically, in whether that's, sharing something, to telling your friend about, this great article you read, this great book you read. Basically, it's protest culture that we should be encouraging through art at the moment, because I think in the last however many years, it has been slowly defanged again. There's been all these ups and downs, and I think in wartime especially, you can see a lot more acts of resistance, as we have seen, around the time World War II, during the time Cold War. Those things are coming back again, and it is the same actors that, and plus these new forms of power that are coming together to try and enact something else again. And I think there's ways just to like opt out of the machine while still making work that, or amplifying work that is worthwhile and speaks to right now and how we can move towards the future.
So, as privacy campaigner, I advocate for better privacy reform regarding like the Privacy Act that we have here in Australia. And I also help within the organisation to advise the government on how to better protect the privacy of Australians.
Okay, so you're very well placed then to talk about the topic that we're discussing today, which is looking at the regulation of AI. So, yeah, let's get into it. The Productivity Commission released their interim report called Harnessing Data and Digital Technology. I was wondering if you could just give a brief summary of some of the main findings in this report or anything that really struck you after reading this.
Absolutely. So, firstly, a bit of context. The Productivity Commission is an independent advisory body to the Australian government and was created by Parliament in 1998 to replace the Industry Commission. Now, as you said, on the 5th of August, they published their interim report, and it was largely about AI. Now, the main message of the report emphasised the economic value of using AI tech. For example, companies can use AI to better model competitors, and that will increase competition in the market. Now, the report warns against regulation which might impede these economic gains. Now, everyone loves a healthy economy boost, so why are AI experts and civil society groups such as ours disappointed? Well, it has to do with a few ideas that they float in there, but also just the general message really missed the mark for us. Because firstly, it completely ignored public opinion. Independent research shows that 64% of Australians want stronger regulatory safeguards around AI, and 83% they would say they would trust AI more if proper protections were in place. And the report just does not reflect those community concerns. In fact, the report actively prioritises interests of large US-based AI companies over the rights and safety of Australian workers and citizens. Now, this is because the basis of the report assumes economic benefits when they actually aren't guaranteed. The projected economic boost relies on Australian companies adopting AI to improve productivity and profits. But much of the wealth that is generated by that AI adoption will flow to the corporations which own the AI, and they're mostly in the US and China. The resulting profit increases for Australian companies will partly come from AI-fueled cost-cutting measures, such as replacing workers with AI, meaning that these economic gains won't necessarily reach ordinary Australians. In fact, they might actually disadvantage them. Now, this is massive, and the report really just skims over this. And without regulation, AI can pose serious human rights issues, from the content they're capable of generating all the way to the biases that they can perpetuate. So a regulation as a last resort approach to AI is a really big red flag for groups like ours.
Yeah, thank you so much for that summary of the report. It's really interesting that you note that these so-called economic benefits won't actually positively impact many everyday people, but instead flow to the big tech companies overseas that are already making so much money and accumulating so much wealth from this technology. I wanted to go into the regulation of AI in a bit more detail. Can you talk about what that would potentially look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we're saying the word regulation of AI, it can sound really boring, but it has some pretty serious real-life impacts. For example, the Commission warns against introducing technology-specific regulations and suggests that the government should rely on existing laws instead. This means applying existing legislation to entirely new scenarios, and this is a mistake. AI is evolving so rapidly and its capabilities are so unique that existing legislation just doesn't cover many of the harms it causes. For example, deepfake technology. Currently, under sections of the Criminal Code 1995, it's an offence to use a carriage service in a way that's menacing, harassing, or offensive. There's also civil action a victim of a deepfake might take, but there's currently no laws prohibiting the actual creation of the deepfake software, or the act of creating a deepfake and then distributing it. So unless they fit the existing narrow definitions, it leaves huge gaps in protection, particularly for women and children. An AI free-for-all might sound like equality in action, but in practice, unregulated AI models amplify existing biases and can become really powerful means of oppression and harassment. So when we're talking about AI regulation, we're talking about how it's created. We're talking about putting safeguards in place to actually restrict those biases and make it so the people who are using AI, which is essentially everyone today, even if you don't know it, if you use Google Translate, you talk to Siri in your car, you even do a Google search, you're using AI, so this affects you. And these broader regulations on how AI is created has a massive trickle-down effect to how it's used by people in the day-to-day and the effects that it has.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Lucinda. You were saying before that obviously this will have a big impact, without the regulation of AI, this will have a big impact on everyday people. You mentioned, you know, a lot of the so-called profits would end up going to big companies and potentially disadvantage Australian workers. But from your work as a privacy campaigner, can you tell us a bit more about how the privacy of everyday people would be affected by a lack of regulation of these technologies?
Yeah, absolutely. So one example of a privacy concern has to do with technology and data mining. And this is something that the report actually floats. It says maybe a technology and data mining exemption for big tech would be a good idea. Now, what this means is data mining uses advanced algorithms and computing techniques to sift through large volumes of raw data. So I'm talking everything from novels, to social media, maybe even your posts, journal articles, blogs you might have written, and even copyrighted material as well. And allowing AI to access this data and train using it with zero restraint results in industrialized level of copyright infringement and an acceleration of mass data extraction and corporate surveillance as well. Because what it does is it makes the data that companies are holding on you even more valuable, because they can then give that to AIs and that AI can use it. So it's incentivizing companies to hold even more data and essentially surveil, which is really problematic for our privacy. And this has already caused enormous problems for our democracy by proliferating disinformation in our civic spaces and creates enormous cybersecurity risks, as millions of Australians that are already caught up in data breaches know all too well. Now, another point is that AI is advancing so quickly. Scientists from OpenAI, Anthropic and Meta and other leading AI developers recently published a paper where they all agreed, which is really rare, warning that we are close to losing the ability to understand how some AI systems actually make decisions, meaning we're not going to know how they're reaching the decisions they make. We don't know what data, or we might not know the data that they're using. And that is really problematic because there could be all sorts of privacy invasions within that.
That was Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch. To learn more about your privacy rights online, head to digitalrightswatch.org.au. Before that, we heard from Cher Tan, essayist and critic. To read her article, Spotify is Worse Than You Think, head to killyourdarlings.com.au. The book mentioned throughout the interview is called Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist by Liz Pelly. Liz Pelly is speaking in NAMM at the upcoming Now or Never Festival. So for more information, head to nowornever.melbourne.vic.gov.au. That's all for Women on the Line today. We would love to hear any comments or thoughts you have about the program, so please send us an email at womenontheline@gmail.com or give us a call at 3CR on 03 9419 8377. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. Women on the Line is a national feminist current affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women and gender non-conforming broadcasters from 3CR in NAMM, Melbourne, and broadcast across so-called Australia on the Community Radio Network with funding support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The theme music for Women on the Line is by Ripley Kavara. All Women on the Line programs can be downloaded from 3cr.org.au/womenontheline. I'm Phuong Tran. Tune into Women on the Line next week on your community radio station.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.